You're listening to the Cubicle to CEO podcast, episode 140. Today's case study features artist Linda Yee, founder of Panda Cub Stories. Linda became her own patron and went from making $250 a month on Patreon to reaching her first $10,000 month with Panda Cub Diner, an online course she first created inside our three-day Paid to Create challenge. Panda Cub Diner teaches Chinese food lovers how to love making healthy and authentic Sichuan food at home. If you, like Linda, also sell a service or product that is not centered on business or making your customers more money, you'll especially love Linda's advice on how to still convey the important value of the work you do. Linda also speaks candidly with us about what it's like to build a business as a neurodivergent entrepreneur who is diagnosed with ADHD and the practices that have helped her in her mental health journey. Take a listen. Welcome to the Cubicle to CEO podcast. I'm your host and marketing minimalist, Ellen Yin. I'm a first-generation Asian-American founder who profitably grew my business to $1 million by age 26 with no funding or debt. Now I'm on a mission to share what I've learned to help you scale your own impact and income. Whether you're trying to escape an actual cubicle or breaking out of a figurative box that has kept you stuck, we're giving you access to the best and brightest minds in business on our show every Monday. Listen in as these leaders impart their wisdom, inspiration, and encouragement to empower you to become the CEO of your dream business and life. All right, friends, I have Linda Yee with us here today. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Ellen. Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm so excited to have you on. I was telling Linda before we hit record that this morning I put on my Asian American Girl Club shirt. So shout out to AAGC. But it wasn't even planned. Like I actually got their package yesterday in the mail. And so I was just excited to wear it. And it's, you know, casual Friday, even though we work for ourselves, right? And then of course I looked at my schedule and I was like, oh yeah, I'm talking with Linda today. And then I get on Zoom with her. And if you guys are watching this on YouTube right now, you'll see it in the background. But if you are not, and you're just listening to this, like go find our YouTube clip, because behind Linda on her wall is just a whole collage and mural of all of her incredible artwork and these beautiful Chinese characters that she has. I don't know, is that painted or colored?
It's painted, yeah. So these, I can never point in the right place. These are the original watercolor paintings. And then that's a poster where they're like shrunk down to about a quarter size. So wow. That all 100 are in the same place.
It's gorgeous, you guys. So feast your eyes on this beauty. Make sure you go find the YouTube clip. But Linda, we are so excited to have you. I would love for you to give our listeners the short, you know, 1 to 2 minute version of your story from cubicle to CEO, that journey of going from being an employee to working for yourself as an entrepreneur.
Great. All right. Well, hopefully I practiced this enough. I'm a very scatterbrained. So usually my stories, I've already begun, like go off the rail. Yeah. So I'm Linda. I founded Panda Cub Stories, which is both a webcomic. It started as a comic strip. And now it's an online platform where I teach programs related to Chinese culture. So specifically Chinese language, as well as recently Sichuan food. And so it's called Panda Cub Stories, partly because I was born in Chengdu, which I believe Ellen was as well. We learned that. And that is the home of the giant pandas. And so I immigrated with my family to the U.S. when I was 4. So when I was just a panda cub. And that's kind of like the origin of the name. So I went to Duke as an undergrad and I graduated. And basically, I worked mostly in higher education for the first part of my career. And I didn't start really transitioning until I was 25. And so I went back to grad school. I was very interested in children's literature and art, which is where I painted these paintings. But even after that pivot, I kind of like sort of tried a lot of different things and was trying to find my path for about 4 or 5 years before last year, which is when I actually started my business, which kind of transformed my like exploring in multiple ways of like, this is the art I like. This is the art I like to make. is this art people will buy? Is it art people will publish? To really being able to take kind of my destiny in my own hand and yeah, and then build out my business alongside my artwork.
Wow. So I'm assuming, because I mean, at least most artists that I know, it's a mix of, you know, innate talent and of course practice over years. So I'm assuming that even though you started to make that transition to becoming an entrepreneur when you were 25, that art has probably had a large impact on your life for many, many years before that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've been drawing and painting for all of my life. So like one of my earliest memories is like, you know, scribbling on a piece of paper with a crayon and like drawing versions of stories that I was listening to on like books on tape, like literal audio tape, because I'm that old. yeah. And I was actually an art major in college, which was very unusual because I went to Duke University. And if anyone knows, like, that's not an art school. And especially when I was there, like, you know, they hadn't even built their arts building yet. Like, it was a very tiny arts program. And that was kind of a surprise for my family because I was political science for the majority of the time. But I like switched basically. So I guess like the transition was like, oh, I want to focus on art. Early on, but I could just never really see a way to do it while also being responsible to my family. And, you know, like, I don't know if you got any of this growing up, but my parents are quite traditional in a lot of ways. And that means that they want security for me, right? And usually security means financial security, which means a time-proven path, which being an artist is not.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to a lot of that. I feel very fortunate because my parents, they were very strict and traditional in many ways in terms of, you know, expectations of academic performance and excellence in our extracurriculars and going to, you know, a top ranking university. And so those were, you know, things typical of growing up as, you know, an Asian American, as you know, that I did experience. But I will say that my parents from really quite an early age have always really had so much support for whatever career path we chose. So they were never, you know, they were never the ones that typical, you know, oh, you need to be a doctor, lawyer, engineer. And that honestly was not important to them. They wanted to make sure that, of course, that we were secure. Like you said, I think that is very much a part of the culture, wanting to make sure that their kids are taken care of and setting up a successful future. But I do feel lucky that I, like you, was given opportunities to explore my creativity and things that I genuinely enjoyed. And so I know that for you as an artist, as a creator, now as a course creator and educator, that Panda Cub Stories has existed in many different formats over the years in your exploration of how to monetize this passion of yours, right? And most recently, you know, you've added educator to your title with Panda Cub Diner. And so tell us about, like, why did you decide to go into course creation as a monetization strategy? Because that's not always super common for artists, right?
Yeah. So it's interesting that I added educator to my title now, because education is where I came from. So I was in higher education administration at the time. And I like worked for a program called the Duke Talent Identification Program. So I was in charge of running the China campus. So I would actually like fly over and work with students and teachers as well. And so, and when I was kind of like, you know, trying out Panda Cub Stories as like an art business, and I also did like a podcast and a YouTube channel, what I did for money was I taught part-time at a Mandarin immersion preschool. So I was a Laotian. I was an educator in that sense.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, teaching very tiny tots. And I also freelanced as a curriculum writer for an online Mandarin education business. So I helped like plan out curriculum as well as write out scripts. But that was always like very separate from both my own art as well as my own bottom line, right? It was always like working in the service of someone else. So I always knew that I loved teaching. But, you know, apart from like briefly considering, well, maybe I can like teach art on the side, right? Like I never really thought about doing that for my own business or for like my own core career path. So to back up a little bit, I created the Panda Cup Diner, my course, actually because I took your Paid to Create program. And at that time, the course idea was like very, very nascent. So I had already been drawing my comics about Chinese language and culture. And I had mentioned a couple of months previously that I was, you know, relearning how to cook Sichuanese food that I'd grown up with, like that I had cooked before, but just hadn't cooked in years since leaving home. And some of my readers expressed interest in like, oh, like, how do you make your family's chili oil? Like, how do you use this dish? And so I started like giving, you know, just some tutorials via DM, and that sparked the idea of, oh, maybe I can make this into a larger course. And I took Paid to Create and I signed up for Haley's program, which is a program called Recurring Profit. And it kind of snowballed from there. Yeah, like I don't think I would have been able to create the course had I not had the guidance and the structure that was already there. So I think I owe a lot of that to you and Haley.
Thank you. Well, that means the world to hear. And, you know, the timing of this conversation, we're recording this on a Friday, and we actually just wrapped up our fifth live cohort of Paid mm-hmm. to Create. So, Linda, I think you were in the September 2021 class, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a few cohorts passed, but it's just such an incredible experience. For those of you who are new to our world, maybe you're listening to the show for the first time, Paid to Create is our live 3-day course creation challenge, where we help first-time course creators turn the knowledge that's already in their head into a digital product that they can sell over and over again. And what's unique about our challenge is that we help people actually enroll paying students in their program before they even finish creating the course. So we utilize a pre-sale method, and that's the challenge that Linda came into, you know, this world with. And it's been so cool to watch your growth both through the challenge and now in, you know, in Haley's program, who is a dear friend of mine. So Linda, speaking of that, that brings us perfectly into the case study at hand today, which is how you went from making $250 a month through Patreon to actually reaching your first $10,000 a month with your program, with your online course. That's an incredible leap. And so the first thing that comes to mind for me is Patreon, even though I've never personally used it, I know a lot of creators and especially artists use it as a way for their community or their fan base to support them, right? With, I believe it's monthly recurring subscriptions, yeah. Right?
Correct.
So where did you feel like Patreon was, maybe not even the platform necessarily, but just the model that you were pursuing to monetize your work? Why was that not working for you?
Yeah, so several things. So a lot of different creators use Patreon, and some of them are able to turn it into their full-time income. So like, it's nothing against Patreon. I do think it's like specifically the type of work I create. So right now I write and illustrate comics. The like people generally expect to get that for free, right? Like you can read it for free on Webtoons, you can read it for free on Instagram. And so I think like in the beginning, like trying to think of it as a business was difficult for me as a creator, because I'm like, well, people like, you know, like would people pay like for this if they can just get it for free? But also like from a I guess like audience standpoint, right? Like there was a pretty large hurdle to cross to convince people to pay for things. So I think being able to make $250 a month after fees was already quite good for the niche that I was in, because like a lot of other webcomics sort of at my like audience space, like, you know, they'd be making like $50 a month or $70 a month. And then I was also looking at the comic artists that I really, really admired who had not like published traditionally, but were just relying on either freelance or Patreon to cover their bills. And there's one person who he has like 150K, you know, readers on Instagram, over a million readers on Webtoons. But like just seeing his posts and, you know, like begging people almost to just like pay $1 a month, right, to help me out. And then there were like so many people going like, I would, but I can't afford it. And so I think like that was a little discouraging. And at the same time, it's like when I thought about above Patreon, you know, I could do like commissions, which I've done and he does, or the artists who make money via something like Webtoons, where if you're really successful, you get basically salaried by Webtoons to make this comic, but it's still like, you know, $3,000 a month, maybe like $5,000 a month. And then a lot of, say like revenue is lost either to the company or honestly, just like through plagiarism, like people will take screenshots and then post to a free platform. So I think like one of the reasons why I decided I needed something beyond Patreon was like one, it just like, it never felt right to me to market my art. And then when I was thinking about marketing my art, that was also influencing the type of stories and the type of art I was making. And it got to a point where it kind of felt frozen because every time I stopped to write a new piece or make a new piece, like my thought would be like, is this going to work well for the Instagram algorithm, right? People tend to like shorter and sweeter and more simple things that they can just read and laugh at and then just like swipe away from. And so I found myself making more of that, which is fun. But then I was like, I don't know actually if this is the direction I would be going in if I wasn't trying to figure out what was more business savvy. So for the course, I'm able to do that, but not have it influence my art.
That's a really interesting perspective. I'm really glad you said this because I think it's kind of actually a conversation that is, I guess, important just in the time that we live in, right? We kind of live in this society and in this digital age where we almost feel like everything has to be monetized, right? That in so many ways, people have stopped creating or participating in activities just for the sake of enjoyment, just because it is something that they truly love to do without that additional pressure of how do I make money from this? How do I, you know, whatever that looks like. And so I think it's so cool that having your own digital product, your course, aside from your art, gives you that flexibility then to really approach your art with fresh eyes and look at, okay, what do I actually want to create as an artist? Not like, what do I have to create in order to generate revenue from this? Mm-hmm. So with your Panda Cub Diner, when you were in the Pay to Create Challenge, walk us through like the process of when you first launched your beta. And for those who are not familiar with these terms, beta is essentially like your founding group of students. So your students who join before your course is even created in its entirety. So you priced Panda Cub Diner at $297. How many beta students did you get? And then from there, what has been the path to acquire 34 students now total or enroll 34 students that has resulted in your first $10,000 month?
Yeah. So when I did my beta, I did it at like 70% off, like really much lower because nothing had been created yet. So the initial students paid $88 a piece. And I actually like went through after I did the beta, I actually changed the program a little bit more after kind of experiencing a personal epiphany and then also interviewing some of my students. So when we built the course together, it was purely a cooking course. So like, you know, like week one was simple food history about Sichuanese food. Like this is what the ingredients are. And then week two was like setting up our kitchen. Week three was stocking our pantry. And then week four, we learned how to make five simple dishes with three bonus dishes for people who wanted to push themselves more. And I found that like during the time when I was going through the beta with my students, I was having loads of fun. I was cooking all the time. I like hosted three different like Sichuan dinner parties for my friends in New York City because like pandemic restrictions were finally easing up. But then afterwards, I just went for like 2 months and I didn't cook at all. And I felt actually really guilty because I was like, wait a minute, like I built this course promising that like, you know, once you took it, you can just like make Sichuan food whenever and have a lot of fun doing it. So like, why was I still eating takeout for dinner all the time or like doing ramen or like sometimes, you know, like cereal for dinner? Like I fell back onto all of that. And then also looking at, so I use Kajabi for my course and you can track your students' progress through the back end of Kajabi. So I saw that like, you know, a couple of my beta students had gone through the course with me from start to finish, but some of them like either hadn't even like really started completing modules or, you know, they had started and got to like 12% and then just stopped. And so this was kind of at the point where at the end, December of 2021, I sort of went back to the drawing board and I was like, okay, wait a minute. What is going on? I no longer felt comfortable selling the product when I felt like I wasn't walking the walk. And what I realized was, and after I sent surveys to the students who hadn't completed the course, was that there was this initial level of excitement in learning this new thing for them, or relearning this thing that I really loved and cared about, Sichuan food. And while they were in it, in the live experience, that was very motivating. There was group accountability. And so the people who did show up live, including myself as the teacher, got a lot out of it in that sense. But students who signed up for the beta, but were like, oh, maybe I'll do this later. Or me, who after the beta, I was working on, it was also the holidays, but I was working on planning how to scale it, trying to work out what marketing looked like, completing the other modules in recurring profit, that I think I got into this mindset of I'm very stressed and pressured and I don't have time to do anything except my business, right? Mm-hmm. And I was still trying to create art consistently on the side for my Patreons. So I got to this place where I had a mindset of, I don't have time to eat healthy, to cook, to take care of myself. And I just let it go. So basically in January of this year, I went back and implemented some of the feedback that my students gave me. And what I realized as a result, that not only was I trying to teach people how to cook in Panda Cub Diner, and honestly, my first beta student was myself, because the whole thing started out because I was I'm going to relearn how to make my family's dishes. And I thought the only thing standing in the way was my kitchen wasn't prepped, right? I didn't have my own wok. I didn't have this giant patch of chili oil to fall back to all the time. And then I realized that all of those things are really important and helpful and take hurdles away from cooking. But if I didn't have the kitchen systems or habits or mindset in place that made consistent cooking, regardless of cuisine, what I wanted to do and looked forward to doing, it wasn't going to happen. So kind of the second iteration of Panda Cup Diner was adding modules and support systems for that. So basically once I finished the second version of the program, and now there's a live option every month that I do teach live. And that's actually very beneficial for me because oh, it's the third week, we're making chili oil. Do I need to replenish my own chili oil?
Right.
The answer is yes. And so I'll do it live with my students. And I find that has been very energizing for me. And that has worked really well with this first official cohort of Panda Cub Diners. So now the full price is $297. And if people pay in full at the webinar, it's $249. So they're able to get 2 months off.
Amazing. And I love what you said about how there's something about showing up live, whether as a student or as an educator, that is just a very different energy, that extra layer of accountability. And I think that's honestly why the pre-sell method works so well for creating a course, is because you do have that accountability and responsibility to your founding students who have paid you for an unfinished course to actually show up for them and live teach them. And it basically removes all barriers of procrastination, because unlike when you create a course on your own, right? You can't just push it off till next week if you know that people are depending on you to show up and create the content live, teach the content that they have paid you for. So I think that's an important element to call out. And another reason that we even host Pay to Create as a live challenge versus just as a recorded course. In fact, people sometimes will DM me saying, hey, can I just buy the recordings from a past round? And I actually turn them away and I say, unfortunately, no, just because I don't think you're going to get the best experience and results out of that versus if you were able to show up live. So I love that you offer both options. I'm curious though. So one thing you said is that you made pivots based on the feedback that you received from your audience, from your students, as well as just looking at the data in terms of course completion rates and whatnot. I'm sure there's people listening into this podcast who are also fellow course creators, fellow educators. I would love to know, like, what is a key question or maybe a couple key questions that you actually asked your students? Like, specifically, what were those questions that you asked that allowed you to receive the helpful feedback that you needed to implement those changes?
Yeah. So, I think the first thing I would say is I actually got on calls with people. Like, I didn't send a general survey, which I think I also asked questions through this chat group that we had. So my beta students and I were all in an Instagram like DM group. So that was for some immediate feedback, but I mostly asked people who didn't go through the entire program, like if I could buy them a Starbucks coffee and just like hop on a call for 30 minutes to talk about their experience. And I think like one of the most helpful questions, and not specifically related to cooking, is like, what are some of the things that get in the way of getting started, right? So not even like, why didn't you complete the program? I used to also be like a researcher in grad school and I did a lot of qualitative interviews. And so like one of the things is you almost never start a question with why, because like it comes off as kind of aggressive, even if you don't mean to be aggressive. But like, I think instead asking them, you know, what are some of the things that get in the way? What are some of the hurdles that kept you from starting? And then also kind of asking, you know, like what were the reasons that you signed up for the program? Like, what are the things that you really wanted to get out of it? And then how do you think we could get you there? Or like, you know, what else could I offer? What other support could I offer to help you get there? What that would have been more helpful. So I think like those were the questions that really got me actionable steps. Cause like, you know, both like answers to what I can create the what, right? Like answers to how I can create processes to support people to, you know, like complete the how. Whereas, you know, if people are just like, you know, I didn't have time, or like, I feel like why questions usually give you sort of more ambiguous answers, or, you know, they'll say like, I don't know, or maybe they'll go down to like, oh, it's my fault. Like, you know, right. I wasn't like disciplined enough. And like, that's not where you want to end the conversation ever as an educator. Like, if I was teaching preschool, like I would never be like, oh yeah, that it's your fault, Tommy, for not like trying hard enough. Like that, you know, that's the surface level answer that you need to dig a little bit deeper into.
Okay, friends, it's time for another lightning round. So Linda, I'm going to fire three questions at you and just answer whatever pops into your mind first.
Great.
Awesome. So question number one, I feel like I had to ask you this because of Panda Cub Diner. What is your number one must try Chinese dish for new explorers of authentic Chinese cuisine? So for those of you listening, if your current experience with Chinese food is limited to like orange chicken and fortune cookies, we're going to have you step outside of that to real authentic Chinese cuisine. So Linda, what's your number one go-to dish to recommend?
So I'm going to pick my go-to Sichuan dish, which is Mapo Tofu. So if like you already know about Chinese food, you probably already know this, but I recommend it because it is such a hearty and satisfying dish that is just as good with meat as it is in its vegetarian / vegan form. So, you know, regardless of what your dietary preferences are, that should be a dish that will work for you, whether you're interested in making it, in which case you can take my class, or if you go to a restaurant and make it. So Mapo Tofu.
One of my all-time favorite dishes. I love the one my mom makes, but I also love seeing how different restaurants recreate that dish in their own unique way. So I love that. Great one. Okay. Question number two, what was your favorite age growing up?
Ooh, my favorite age growing up. I think that would have to be elementary school. So I think like that. And that was also the time where I felt most connected also to Chinese language and culture, because my parents used to sort of like ship me off to China every summer. So I just remember like that's where I really started like blossoming as an artist. I took like a lot of art classes, both in school and out. I started writing my first like stories and short stories around the same time. And it was also like a time of yeah, it felt like structured bliss, right? Because like the adults had like structured things for you, but you were still able to kind of like flourish within it, which I think is where we all want to be today. So
that's a really great phrase. I don't think I've heard someone say structured bliss before, but I feel like that's such an apt description of exactly what you just described.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay. Final question for you. What is the first thing you would do if you won the lottery today?
Ooh, the first thing I would do. So I think the first thing I would do is book, if, you know, COVID wasn't a thing right now and we're allowed to travel to China still, book like maybe a 3-month trip back to Chengdu, take like my boyfriend who has never been there, and do like a 3-month culinary tour. And I think like I would like to bring both of my parents along with us and buy like first class tickets for everyone. They've never flown first class before, and just like really do a both like luxurious but really authentic like tour through Sichuan with my parents who haven't been back for a number of years. And then also with my partner who is Chinese, but like has never been to Sichuan before, so that he can see it through new eyes as well.
Best answer. And you know what, Linda, I have no doubts. Like, you don't need the lottery. You're creating your own lottery in life, right? Through the work that you do. I have no doubt that that trip will come to fruition, probably in the near future. And when it does, I just have to say on behalf of all of us, please document your culinary tour through China on YouTube. Like, you have to vlog the whole thing, because I've got to live that vicariously. And then I'll take your recommendations and do it myself. So I love
that. Fantastic. Yes, that is a promise.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Linda. Oh man, that last couple minutes is just absolute gold. If you are an educator, if you're a course creator, honestly, if you're anyone that just wants to create better content, I think you need to rewind and listen to what Linda said. I love that you brought in your past as a qualitative researcher, because I agree 1000%. I think the specific way that you word a question or the quality of the questions you ask absolutely have an impact on the results that you are able to create, and also the quality of the feedback that you receive. So to your point, I totally understand why the word why may not always be the best way to lead a question, because I feel like just innately it kind of puts somebody on the defense, right? It's like they have to defend their position as to why they feel a certain way or act a certain way about something. And I'll throw in a bonus tip on top of the excellent question reframe that Linda just shared with us. So again, make sure you go back and listen, take notes on how she worded that. But an extra bonus tip for all of you listening is this works, the strategy that Linda shared also works in sales too, right? When you're discussing with someone who may be interested in hiring you for a service or perhaps buying a product from you, it's always a good idea to try to get someone to open up about what are those specific barriers that are preventing them from being able to make a decision, whether it's yes or no, about joining your program or about hiring you for a service? So something I see happen a lot in sales conversations is people say something like, "Let me know if you have any questions," which is a very dead end type of response, because it kind of places the burden on the other person to initiate or reinitiate that conversation if they have something to share, right? So most people actually don't, and that conversation kind of dies. Whereas placing a statement there, if you can rephrase it as a question and instead say something like, you know, "What hesitations do you have about joining this program?" Or, "What other questions do you still have on your mind that I can answer for you?" It just totally redirects the conversation in a very different way. And so that's just a bonus little tip I wanted to tack on to what Linda shared. So super helpful. Thank you. Another question that I had for you, which is why, you know, I'm so excited to have you on the show, is I love that even though you are in the online business world, you work in a specific niche that is not related to business, and it's not related to necessarily making money, right? Like no one's, I mean, I maybe not no one, but probably the majority of people joining Panda Cub Diner are not trying to learn how to cook Sichuanese food to, you know, to sell, right? It's for their own enjoyment. And so I would love for you to share with others who may feel discouraged sometimes, because I hear from a lot of creators and educators who say, you know, My program doesn't teach people how to make money. So I feel like it's hard to convey the value and why someone should pay me for this work or this skill set, right? So can you share some encouragement with how you've been able to overcome that barrier and convey the value to your students for why they should pay to actually learn, you know, how to cook from you versus Googling it or watching it on YouTube, let's say?
Of course. And I think like first, I felt that when I started. And I remember like one of the first business coaches I went to that I didn't like end up hiring full time. Like, you know, one of her tips was, if you want high income months, make high tier offers, right? So like, how can you make a food program where let's say your ideal income month is $10,000 and you only need to make 3 sales if you price your program at like, what was it? $4,500 each. Mm-hmm. And I was like, who the heck would pay me $4,500 to teach them how to cook? Which was also like not the best mindset to have. I've done a lot of mindset work since, and I get where she was coming from, but I do feel like there's a difference between teaching an online course that promises something else, or promises something that isn't, you know, if you invest X amount of dollars in this course, you will get, you know, 3X amount of dollars back in some way.
Right.
And so what I found is that it's not just, you know, the result of like, you will now learn how to cook Sichuan food that people are looking for. A lot of times it's, you know, wanting to join a community of other foodies who are interested in Sichuan food and language and feeling more connected to the culture, which is a huge part of the food, or kind of like someone who loves going through food Instagram posts and watching Food Network. And they're like, I love food. I love looking at it. I love, you know, watching it prepared. I love eating it. But somehow like have this disconnect in their lives, or like when I try to make it, it's so stressful. Either I mess up or I do a really good job and I make this amazing meal. But then the next time I try to get started, it's just like pulling teeth. Like I can't do it. And then a lot of people end up, you know, guilting themselves. Like, why can't you do it? Right. Or like, you just did this before, or you've made this recipe 20 times. Why are you forgetting steps? And all of these things, which are things that I have personally felt. And so kind of the reasons why my students have joined my program have been a mix of those two sort of like pain points. And I've designed my program in a way that addresses those. And so going back to, you know, like why would someone pay $200 for a program that teaches them how to cook when you can get all of that for free by getting a cookbook or Googling a recipe or going to like a YouTube video? And so like what I would say is, you know, all of those things have existed for years, right? But there's a reason why you're asking me this question, or like there's a reason why you haven't achieved the thing that you want to achieve. So like, I can't tell you how many times people have said like, I have 5 cookbooks sitting on my shelf that are beautiful that I've like accrued over the course of years, but I've maybe made like 1 recipe out of them. And a lot of it is if we're trying to learn on our own, often like we get off track, and if there's no one else to bring us back on track, we'll just kind of give up. And that's the nature of life, especially now. Everything is like so hectic and there's so many things like pulling at our attentions. So I would say like the difference between just doing it yourself in DIY versus paying for an online course and basically a mentor to walk you through it is that mentorship and community aspect. And the way also I see online courses is it's sort of this like digital repository or second brain that once I've completed it, I know that I have the skills. And like, yeah, sometimes I will forget things. And for me, I have ADHD. So my working memory is it's very taxed. It's very impaired. Like, you know, I know how to make my family's chili oil sauce. I know how to make like my family's Sichuan sauce. But sometimes if I'm put on the spot, I'll forget ingredients. And that used to just be something that like my family would jokingly say, like, how can you still not remember it? And I'd be like, haha. But in the back of my head, I'm like, yeah, Linda, like, why can't you still remember it? But having sort of this online course with the library that it has makes me feel both safe and confident. So like sometimes I'll refer back to it, but sometimes I don't even need to refer back to it. But just knowing that it's there is so incredibly helpful. I think like that's generally my answer.
I feel like that really speaks to my heart, everything that you just shared about the value of programs and it going so much deeper than just the skill set and the knowledge that you walk away with. I tell all of my students that the true value in every program that you join has more to do with the people that you meet in that space and the relationships that you build with those people, both the mentor as well as your fellow peers. Those relationships will have a much greater impact on your life and your business than any skill really that you could learn from an educator. And so I love that you really highlighted the aspect of community and of mentorship and guidance and people to bring you on track and to keep you accountable. And I think that what you just shared about how, you know, you've walked people through that perspective shift of like, yes, all these free resources exist out there. All this free information, of course, exists out there. But despite that, like you said, despite you having access to that all of these years, you still haven't consistently been cooking Sichuan food. So clearly there's still a missing ingredient there. No pun intended, but you know, yeah. For real, like there's something still
great pun though.
Right? Not clicking there. So I love that reframe. And I think that so many people who teach on topics outside of business, outside of making money or marketing are going to really, really appreciate that. And I also want to just spend our last few minutes talking about something that you brought up just a moment ago, which I'm really interested in learning more about because mm-hmm. I don't think we've had a guest on yet that explicitly, you know, has shared that they are neurodivergent. And I know you openly use your platform to talk about both ADHD and anxiety and depression, which I think is so valuable. So I just want to give you this space to share how ADHD and anxiety and depression have impacted you as an entrepreneur. And if you have any insight on practices or habits that you've developed over the years that have helped you tackle growing a business with those pieces of you, I think that people would really, really find that helpful.
Yeah, of course. So I would say I'm a like later in life diagnosis. So I wasn't diagnosed with ADHD until I was 25. And I actually like went in and asked to be assessed because like I had read a couple of books. Like, yeah, it probably took like 2 or 3 years for me to like convince myself that like I wasn't looking for excuses and I wasn't lazy, that I should probably go like talk to someone about this. And even on the way to like the doctor's appointment, I was like, maybe this is a mistake. He's going to just tell me there's nothing wrong with me. And that all of the fears I had, which was like, I was not motivated enough, didn't work hard enough. Like all of those things were true. Mm-hmm. So I have it's called like the inattentive expression of ADHD. So like as a child and as an adult, like I'm very rarely physically impulsive. Mm-hmm. And so if, you know, there are any parents out there, teachers out there who are currently like working with children, and it's getting better now, but like children with the more inattentive expression often get overlooked. And usually like ADHD in girls look like that, right? So like when we think ADHD, sometimes we think like really boisterous boy, can't like, you know, keep seated, you know, can't keep his hands to himself or whatever. But like this also manifests in wandering attention or, you know, being told to do like many things and maybe doing some of those things and like seeming like you're flaky or you're forgetful and not getting to the other ones, or, you know, someone who's like, it takes time to get started or you procrastinate a lot. So all of these things that I think like I had considered character defects to begin with. And growing up as well, like I was a good student, right? Like I had a good career before quitting and trying to do my own thing. So I was very high functioning, but that also came at the cost of a lot of like white knuckling through things. Like the way I used to study for exams, for example, was incredibly inefficient because like I couldn't remember stuff. So I would literally just record myself reading lecture notes and just like listen to it on loop. And like I did well on the exam, but then like that's not the way you deep learn something, right? So then I would forget it immediately afterwards. So just looking back, I remember there were also like subjects that I thought that I was not good at or could not be good at, or it was more like I was like, I tricked my teachers into thinking I'm good at it. But if they really asked me 2 months down the line, like I couldn't do it. Or if I'm put on the spot often, like I'll panic and I'll mess up. And so like, I used to hate going to piano competitions or going to interviews because like that environment made my performance just like plummet. And yeah, and I think like one of the reasons why I never thought I could be a doctor or a lawyer. And one of the reasons I fought so hard against, you know, my father in particular, who tried to push me into those pathways. Part of the reason, which was true, was like, I'm not passionate about those subjects. I love writing stories. I love creativity. But I think part of it was also like, I knew without words, the limitations I thought my brain gave me. So I was like, I can't go into trial. And this is like when I was 16, so far away from like being a lawyer, right? Like for someone with ADHD, there's like time blindness, like everything is now. So like, I'd be thinking, I'm going to send someone to prison because I'm going to forget like a note here, or like, I'm going to forget what to say, even though I rehearsed it like many, many times before. And like, same thing with being in the medical field. So I also feel like one of the reasons why I gravitated towards being an artist was I thought that would save me from that pressure, which is not always true. It's like, sure, the pure creation of it is very fun and is very joyful. And my kind of wandering attention, my divergent thinking helps a lot with it. But when it comes to building a career around that profession, I still needed all of the things that I felt I could not do. And so, yeah, so to kind of bring it back, after I got my diagnosis and started taking medication, which was incredibly helpful. But I think like the thing that was most helpful were the behavioral adjustments and things I learned to, and originally this was like when I was in school, like how do I work with my brain to be successful, for example, in grad school, actually like helped a lot in managing my own time and both like strategizing for my business, as well as managing the day to day.
Can you give an example of like one behavioral adjustment, for example, that you've made recently or over the years that has really had a big impact?
Yeah. So one would be flexible time blocking. So I'm sure that you've heard about time blocking before. And I'm a big fan of it, but I used to just beat myself up when I couldn't stick to what I said I was going to do, right? So like for anyone who doesn't know, like sort of blocking out your schedule is a really good productivity tool where you account for almost every single hour of your day, right? I'm going to wake up and do this. And then for the first 2 hours, I'm going to answer emails. And then, you know, for the next 2 hours, I'm going to draw or like take client work, et cetera. And so, you know, sometimes I would do that and have a streak of a week where I was really good. And then I would have a week where I'm like, I just don't feel like doing the client work, or I don't feel like doing the emails, but then I'm like, but that's what I should be doing. And then sometimes like, I'm like, I'll take a break for a minute. And then it's like a complete wash. I lose the entire day. And then that makes me feel guilty and I'll lose the entire weekend. And it's like, then the panic sets in. And it was just like a very unhealthy way of approaching things that like didn't really affect my clients. Like I still got things done in time, but that probably meant I pulled 2 all-nighters or something. Mm-hmm. And so the slight adjustment I made was like flexible time blocking, where my every single day and week are chunked out in hours. And I devote like, say, 12 hours to comic making a week. And then those are scheduled for specific days. And I'll be like, I devote like 4 hours to taking courses to professionally develop. And that's scheduled for a certain day. But then I give myself the leeway to change that up within the week. It's almost like you're moving around Legos and you're like, you know, so that way, like, I know I'm still meeting my obligations, but I'm not too hard on myself on the day to day. And that has made a vast difference.
That's incredible. It kind of reminds me of almost like flexible budgeting, right? Like with money, mm-hmm. where if you have, let's say, $200 of discretionary cash that you have to spend each month, and maybe you allocate $50 towards shopping and another $50 towards entertainment. But then over the course of the month, maybe like every single week in May, it just happens that, you know, a really awesome movie is coming out. So you want to go to the movies every Friday, and you can move some of those funds over from shopping into entertainment, but still stay within that $200 cap for whatever it is. So that is such a great tip. I feel like I need to utilize that more often for myself. And even though, I mean, I'm not aware of having a diagnosis of being neurodivergent, but I do struggle sometimes with that, that feeling of, oh man, like I said, you know, from 10 to 12, I was going to be doing this. And then, you know, something else gets in the way. And then I feel like, oh, maybe I messed up the rest of that schedule for the day. And so I'm definitely going to implement that. So that was a great tip. Thank you, Linda, for sharing that. And thank you also for, you know, coming on to be transparent about your own experience as an entrepreneur with ADHD. And I think we could have a whole, you know, full-blown hour-long discussion just about that piece. So we may have to do like a round table or a panel or some type of summit in the future and have you back for that piece.
That would be awesome.
Yes. Okay, good. I'm glad. So Linda, my final question to you today is, what does being a CEO mean to you?
Yeah. So Ellen, for me, being a CEO means having the freedom to do what I love to do, but then also speaking as an artist, like not almost infantilizing myself by thinking that I need something external to allow me to have the freedom. So, you know, like deciding that like I want to create, for example, art for a living, right? Taking almost life by the horns and making sure that if I can't immediately get a book deal, or, you know, if there's not like a major patron supporting me, or like, you know, I don't win a giant grant, which like all of these things, you know, I can work really hard to try and get to, but at the end of the day, there's a gatekeeper. And so for me, being what a CEO like means to me is then backing up and taking the steps that are necessary and needed and getting the help, asking for help, knowing where to go for help, whether it's taking a course or hiring someone to, you know, do a couple hours of freelance work that will then allow me to build the scaffolding that will actually make that dream come true. Because like for me, it's like I am sort of in the middle of, you know, do what you love, pursue your dreams, don't let a toxic family culture keep you back, which like, you know, I feel like those things are true for some people, but especially coming from an immigrant background, like I love my parents and they're not wrong for wanting a secure future for me. And so I think like for me, being a CEO also means building a business that allows me to take care of both myself and them, as well as creating the freedom that allows me to live the life that I want to live.
That is so beautiful. Oh my gosh. Well, I can only imagine that your parents are so proud of you and everything, you know, that you have created and following your own path, forging your own way in this world. And I can resonate on so many levels, just having come from a similar background, from our birthplace all the way to, you know, immigrating to the States at a similar age, and just growing up in a multicultural, you know, environment, right? With your Chinese family at home and then growing up in America, going to school and all of that. So Linda, I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation today. Thank you so much for being a guest. And for those of you who are interested in Panda Cub Diner, learning more about Linda's program, she has a totally free training for you that I think all of you would love. So Linda, do you want to quickly let them know where they can watch that training and what it's called?
Yeah, of course. So you can watch it at pandacubdiner.com. So panda and then C-U-B, cub, like baby panda, diner.com.
Awesome. And we'll make sure to link that in the show notes below, as well as all of Linda's links. So make sure if you have enjoyed this conversation, you want to follow Linda and experience more of her world, definitely check out the show notes.
Thank you so much, Ellen.
We'll be right back.
Thank you again for tuning in to the Cubicle to CEO podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can help support this podcast in one of three ways. One, post a screenshot of this episode to your IG story and tag me at Miss Ellen Yin so I can repost you. Two, share this podcast with a friend. And three, leave a positive review on Apple Podcasts so we can continue to grow and reach more listeners. Please make sure to also subscribe so you don't miss out on new weekly episodes coming to you every Monday. And friends, until next time, keep dreaming big.